to U.S. encirclement and heightened U.S. military activity, okay? And Blinken, that's why we need to look at this, you know, Blinken's statement, you know, it's a warmongering statement. I mean, they came like gangbusters in the Anchorage meeting about 2 months ago, where Blinken...
We have 10 seconds, Walden.
Yes. Acted so arrogantly towards the Chinese, you know? So I guess my point is this. Trump's anti-China policy is now also being followed by the administrations of the Biden administration's
We're going to have to leave it there, but we will continue to explore this issue. Thank you so much to Walden Bello, acclaimed Filipino scholar. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is...
My name is Ender Black. I am producer and host of the monthly youth Native American radio show, Squirrel Snow. And Squirrel Snow is broadcast the fourth Friday of the month, 8 to 10 p.m. The term growing the grassroots reminds me of the idea of giving people, citizens, the opportunity to voice not only their opinions, but who they are, their beliefs, because in this way, we are able to balance out the output of media. So it's a real gift, and I'm just very blessed to be part of this community radio experience. KBOO helps grow the grassroots of the community by doing what they do best, which is providing a platform. A real platform for people such as myself to communicate who they are, their beliefs, their ideas, their thoughts, their emotions. And this is, in my view, one of the most helpful things a nonprofit can do. And it's definitely for me what America, for the United States, is about, this freedom of speech, the freedom to communicate. Reach out. Thank you, KBOO. Remember, don't forget to go to the website. kboo.fm/give and support KBOO right now. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, 15 Oregon counties will be moving back down to the high-risk category on Friday. A U.S. District Court judge has struck down the national eviction moratorium. And in international news, India continues to be hit hard by COVID-19, receiving little foreign help with their vaccine shortage. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 5th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. Half of Oregon's counties will be moved back down to the high-risk category. This change comes a week after the governor elevated 15 counties to the extreme risk category due to high coronavirus hospitalization numbers. The threshold for extreme risk was a 15% hospitalization rate, and this week, Oregon clocked in a 14.9% rate, just barely escaping the extreme risk category. The decreased risk levels apply to 15 counties, and it means that indoor dining can return to 25% capacity, and gyms, theaters, and museums can get increased capacity as well. The new risk levels take effect on Friday, and all the Portland Tri-County area is now in high risk. Oregon State University is the first public university in Oregon to require students and employees to get coronavirus vaccines. Other private universities in the state have already taken this step. Students and faculty working off-site won't be required to get the vaccine, but they will be strongly encouraged, according to university administration. Two other large public universities in the state, the University of Oregon and Portland State University, have not made similar announcements, though Portland State says they are strongly encouraging their students to get the vaccine. The Oregon Health Authority reported 808 new cases of COVID-19 on Wednesday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 188,417 people. Oregon health officials also reported one new death, raising the state's death toll to 2,509 people. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases on Wednesday with 164, followed by Clackamas County with 119. There are currently 330 people hospitalized statewide, including 83 patients in intensive care. Nationally, the U.S. has reported about 32.6 million cases of COVID-19. At least 578,000 people have died. So far, more than 44% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine, with 32% fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has infected more than 154 million people. At least 3.2 million have died. Coronavirus eviction bans are in danger in many parts of the country. A federal judge issued a ruling today that would revoke the national pandemic eviction moratorium put in place by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC. The case was brought by the Alabama Association of Realtors, who argued that the CDC doesn't have the power to tell landlords they can't evict people during a pandemic. The judge's ruling indicates she agrees with that sentiment. The Public Health Service Act empowers the CDC to make and enforce regulations that are necessary to, quote, prevent the introduction, transmission, or spread of communicable diseases like COVID-19. U.S. District Court Judge Dabney Friedrich wrote in her ruling that she believes the CDC overstepped its bounds on this case, writing that the Public Health Service Act does not grant the CDC the power to impose a nationwide eviction moratorium. The Justice Department is appealing on behalf of the CDC. The Census Department says over 7 million people in the United States are still behind on rent, and even though Congress authorized about $50 billion in rental assistance money, most people who need it haven't seen any of it yet. If the ruling isn't reversed on appeal, it's likely that many of those individuals and families will be evicted, increasing the grim houselessness problem much of the country is already facing. The pharmaceutical giant Pfizer reported $3.5 billion in revenue from its COVID vaccine in the first 3 months of this year. That translates to $900 million in pre-tax profits. The company expects the vaccine to bring $26 billion in total revenue by the end of the year. Out of the 2.5 billion vaccine doses that Pfizer plans to produce this year, the company has pledged to send less than 2% of its inventory, up to 40 million doses, to COVAX, the global facility that supplies vaccines to poor countries. Similarly, Moderna plans to send less than 4% of its vaccine stock to COVAX. Pfizer expects to apply to the Food and Drug Administration in September for emergency authorization to give its coronavirus vaccine to children between the ages of 2 and 11. By early next week, the FDA is expected to issue an emergency use authorization allowing the vaccine to be used in children ages 12 to 15 years old. People around the country report that healthcare is much harder to afford than necessities like food, rent, and transportation, but most would still call healthcare a necessity. Roz Brown has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Texans say healthcare is harder to afford than such necessities as food, utilities, mortgage or rent, and transportation, according to a new survey by the Episcopal Health Foundation. For the third year, the foundation's chief communications officer, Brian Sasser, says a survey shows more than half of all Texans say they aren't keeping up with their healthcare needs because it costs too much. He adds those who are uninsured report an even tougher time paying medical bills or even accessing basic health services.
When you see so many people skipping or postponing care, not filling prescriptions, then we're not talking about huge medical bills from some complex surgery. We're talking about checkups and routine visits.
Texas has more uninsured people than any other state, including workers with jobs at grocery stores, childcare centers, and construction sites. To reduce health care costs, the Episcopal Health Foundation has encouraged state lawmakers to expand Medicaid in Texas, one of 12 states that has not done so. The poll found almost 80% of uninsured Texans under age 65 say paying for health care is difficult for their family, with half describing it as very difficult. Immigrants and Black and Hispanic residents all reported more severe problems paying for health care than white residents. Sasser says chronic health conditions that suddenly become unbearable often send Texans to an emergency room, which ultimately affects all residents and the local economy.
If you have a chronic condition and you can't afford to go to the doctor and it gets worse, there's two things that are going to cost you money. One, you're not going to go to work. And two, when you do get really sick, you're going to go to the ER.
It's estimated if Texas opted for a Medicaid expansion, the state could get more than $5.5 billion in federal funding over 2 years, assuming 1 million uninsured people eligible for coverage signed up for the program. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Last week, India accounted for nearly one-half of the world's new COVID-19 cases and around one-quarter of the world's deaths due to COVID-19. India reported yesterday that it had surpassed 20 million coronavirus infections, with cases growing by more than 2 million in the past week. The actual numbers of cases and deaths in India is believed to be much higher than the official count. India's outbreak is exacerbated by shortages of vaccines, hospital beds, and medical supplies, including oxygen. Neighboring countries have canceled flights and closed borders with India to protect themselves amid fears over India's catastrophic second wave and more contagious variants of the virus. The closures may be coming too late, as outbreaks are surging in Nepal and Pakistan, which border India, as well as Laos, Thailand, and other Southeast Asian nations. All of these countries are experiencing severe shortages of the vaccines as manufacturers continue to fight pressure to suspend patent protections. If the patents were shared with other countries, this would allow broader worldwide production and distribution, ultimately saving more lives. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland testified Tuesday in front of a House committee on the president's 2022 budget request for the Department of Justice. With more on that story and others, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. Attorney General Merrick Garland testified Tuesday before a House committee on the president's 2022 budget request for the Justice Department. Members asked Garland about border security, marijuana laws, domestic terrorism, and voting. The attorney general noted an increased need to preserve voting rights in parts of the country with a history of racial discrimination.
That's part of the reason why we're asking for the 15.8% increase in the budget for the Civil Rights Division.
New polling shows America's youngest voters are changing their views of Biden as the administration passes its first 100 days. Their views also are evolving about the future of the Republican Party, mental health, and the impacts of social media. John Della Volpe is head of polling at Harvard's Kennedy School Institute of Politics.
So young people see that the political institutions were actually listening to them, perhaps for the first time in their lives. And I think that goes a long way to explaining why there is so much hope
According to the poll, most young voters say they approve of the job Biden is doing, favor progressive policies, and have faith in their fellow Americans. Meanwhile, the Census Bureau has released two data sets showing long-term demographic trends. The numbers of Hispanics, Asian Americans, and multiracial voters grew over the last two presidential races, while white voters dipped from 73% in 2016 to 71% in 2020. As the country continues its vaccination campaign, Biden gave an update on the administration's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, including the goal of administering at least one vaccination to 70% of the nation's adult population by July 4th. He said vaccinating children remains a priority.
First, kids, children between the ages of 12 and 15 years of age. They're not yet eligible for a vaccine. The FDA scientists are currently reviewing the data to decide if and when to authorize that age range for vaccination.
Biden also said the administration has launched vaccines.gov, a new website for finding nearby vaccination locations. In Arizona, contractors hired by the state's Senate GOP still are auditing presidential election results in Maricopa County, where some Republicans allege rampant voter fraud occurred. Audit procedures were recently revealed by a court order. Washington's Secretary of State Kim Wyman says the audit raises broader questions about the dangers of partisan vote counts and the increasing shift towards politicization of the way elections are run.
You know, you look at what's happening in Arizona, and you can see that the potential for this new concept could spread to other states, and that's equally as alarming.
Biden's win in Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix, helped give him Arizona's 11 electoral votes. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Noise Filter, the show that provides COVID-19 updates and live Q&As to ensure everyone understands the most important information pertaining to the pandemic. That's followed by News from the Boo, your look at what's happening inside KBOO with Interim Station Manager Jenna Yokoyama. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will bring mostly cloudy skies with a high of 65. Today in history, in 1984, Korean-American artist Joanna Hedva was born. Hedva was known for giving a lecture entitled, "My Body is a Prison of Pain, So I Want to Leave It Like a Mystic, But I Also Love It and Want It to Matter Politically." The talk became known as the Sick Woman Theory. The quote of the day is from activist and author Maryam Kaba, who said, quote, "Let this radicalize you rather than lead you to despair." Advocates around the country are using this week to draw awareness to missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. With more on that story, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Advocates across the country are drawing awareness to missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, including in South Dakota, as Mike Moen reports.
In recent years, May 5th has served as a day to honor victims, but in 2021, organizers launched an action week. Justice Department data show murder rates for Native American women are more than 10 times the national average. Paula Julian of the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center says there are a lot of underlying factors, including lack of access to legal aid and shelters.
Because we understand that MMIW is part of the spectrum of violence, where there aren't services, then we see that there is a greater likelihood that women will go missing or be murdered because they have nowhere to turn to for help.
South Dakota recently approved a specialized office to help find missing Native women and girls. And at the federal level, the Interior Department is starting a new unit to help with such cases. That follows last year's law to spur more efforts from the Justice Department. Julian says it all helps, but it shouldn't just center around data collection and case assistance. She cites the need for restoring more tribal authority to investigate, on top of reducing resource disparities. According to state data, roughly 70% of South Dakota's missing persons cases involve Indigenous people. Julian says economic conditions on many reservations around the state open the door to dangerous situations, including human trafficking.
Not only do you have tribal communities in South Dakota that experience some of the highest rates of poverty and resource disparity, but you see the related rates of violence against women.
And the Resource Center says there are fewer than 60 tribally created or Native-centered domestic violence shelters around the U.S. Despite the gaps, advocates say there's hope, including a new shelter plan for the Rosebud Reservation. Led by a local woman who secured CARES Act funding to make it happen, the facility is geared toward teen girls who are victims of sexual violence.
That was Mike Moen. President Biden has proclaimed Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons Awareness Day. The presidential action is intended to draw awareness and act as a day of remembrance. In the proclamation, Biden commits to working with tribes on the issue. He says his administration is committed to addressing underlying causes, including violence and economic disparities, and for the government to collaborate with tribes. The Navajo Nation won a major court victory last week in a long-running federal lawsuit over access to the Colorado River. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, the tribe contends the U.S. government has not lived up to its trust obligations to provide water.
In 2003, the Navajo Nation sued the U.S. Interior Department, claiming the agency was in breach of the federal government's trust obligation to secure and protect Colorado River water needed by the tribe. The U.S. District Court in Arizona eventually dismissed the case, saying the U.S. hadn't waived its sovereign immunity, a doctrine that holds the federal government can't be sued without its consent. But the Navajo Nation appealed, and the Ninth Circuit Court ruled that past treaties obligated the U.S. to protect the tribe's water resources. The decision sends the case back to the Arizona District Court. Navajo Attorney General Doreen McPaul says it's a significant win for the tribe and that a lack of adequate drinking water contributed to the COVID-19 pandemic's heavy toll on the reservation. It's the second recent court victory for Navajo Nation water rights. In March, the New Mexico Supreme Court dismissed all challenges to a settlement approved by Congress over the tribe's access to the San Juan River, a major tributary of the Colorado. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Advocacy groups fighting hunger want local governments to step in and make sure all residents have access to fresh produce at neighborhood grocery stores and farmers markets. Suzanne Potter has more on this story in California with the Public News Service.
Groups that fight hunger want local government to step in and make sure all Californians have access to fresh produce at neighborhood grocery stores and farmers markets, and they point to South LA as a good place to start. The Crenshaw area lost one grocery store a decade ago, another is closing for renovations, and now Kroger is closing the local Ralph's, saying it can't afford the pandemic hero pay required by the city. Frank Tamborello with Hunger Action LA would like the city and county to tap pandemic relief funds and step in.
We can make sure that stores that are currently planning to close don't close, and that funds are used to keep the employees working there. We can make sure that new supermarkets and neighborhood stores with fresh produce are established in these areas.
The lack of fresh produce, particularly in communities of color, is referred to as food injustice, food apartheid, or food deserts. And the groups working to fight it say the issue has only gotten worse during the pandemic. Jennifer Laurent, an organizer with African Marketplace and Drum Circle Farmers Market in Leimert Park, says big grocery chains should continue to invest in local neighborhoods.
We need large retail grocers who've been in our community that we've been committed to shopping at for 20 and 30 years. We need them to be committed to us and to pay the hero pay and keep the markets open.
She complains the African Marketplace has had a hard time securing an annual permit from the city. Councilman Mark Ridley Thomas's office says it wants to work with organizers to put on a clean, safe weekly event. Tamborello says he hopes the city makes it happen.
People in many neighborhoods cannot go to the store and get adequate fruits and vegetables, and we should have farmers markets on every corner in Los Angeles because we're so close to so many good sources of fresh produce.
The advocacy groups would also like the county to better fund programs like Market Match, which gives SNAP recipients extra dollars to spend at farmers markets. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Tax dodgers could cost the federal government around $7 trillion over the next decade, according to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. Yellen called the $7 trillion gap between what the federal government collects and what it is owed under the current tax code, quote, really shocking and distressing, and that, quote, we're trying to make meaningful steps to close that gap. Representative Ro Khan tweeted in reply, quote, we can start closing the gap next week, pass my Stop Cheaters Act, and audit the ultra-rich. Khan's bill calls for $100 billion in additional funding for the IRS and stricter reporting requirements for wealthy and large corporations. An increase in IRS funding by $80 billion in the next decade is included in President Biden's recently unveiled American Families Plan. The increase in funding would bolster auditing and enforcement. A study released in March by the IRS researchers and academics showed that the richest 1% of American households don't report around 21% of their income, which accounts for roughly a third of all unpaid federal income tax. More than a dozen organizations have signed a letter to candidates running for city offices in New York City, calling on them to make their campaigns more accessible. That includes providing sign language interpreters when they speak, holding campaign events in accessible spaces, and providing accommodations that allow everyone to fully participate in all aspects of elections. Andrea Sears has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Political campaigns must provide reasonable accommodations for people with disabilities. That's a message to candidates for elected office in New York City. More than a dozen organizations have signed a letter to candidates for city offices calling on them to provide sign language interpreters when they speak, to hold campaign events in accessible spaces, and provide other accommodations that allow people to fully participate in every aspect of elections. Susan Dua with the Center for Independence of the Disabled New York points out that's what is required by the Americans with Disabilities Act and City Human Rights Law, but those laws are often ignored.
People need to be able to join in no matter what their disability is, and that's democracy in action.
She says candidates must commit to making their campaign events, literature, and websites accessible both now and after they take office. According to the National Council on Independent Living, 1 in 6 American voters has a disability. Dua reminds candidates that ensuring access to electoral politics is basic to securing equal rights for people with disabilities, and these are people who vote.
We will be looking at which candidates embrace making sure everyone, including people with disabilities, can be part of the electoral process.
The letter also calls on candidates to endorse initiatives that will widen access for people with disabilities to city services and civic life. Dua says lack of accessibility isn't confined to New York City. She says reasonable accommodations are essential at campaign offices and events across the state.
Every town election, every city election, every county election should be following guidance that will help them make their events available to all.
The National Council on Independent Living has compiled a guide for campaign staff to help explain barriers to accessibility and how to overcome them. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
An environmental engineer is launching a sustainability program geared specifically toward the Latino community. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When Christina Garcia began her career as an environmental engineer, she saw few other Latinos or people of color in the industry.
I saw there was a real lack of diversity. All of my colleagues, everyone that I saw in meetings were white, and we're in New York City. I felt that there should be representation that looks like New York City.
So 4 years ago, Garcia founded Latinos in Sustainability, a group within the New York City chapter of the Society of Hispanic Professional Engineers. It provides a space for people starting careers in sustainability to network and learn about important topics in the field. She says that her group has held about 15 events.
And every time there has been a huge confirmation that this group was needed and that students and young professionals are really hungry to understand kind of how they get their foot in the door, because sustainability for so long has been and continues to be kind of this closed circle network that, if, unless you know someone, you know, it's really hard to get your foot in the door.
She says that too often, jobs go to people who have the financial means to intern for free or attend expensive schools. So she wants to make sure that information and new opportunities reach people outside that circle. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is ready to blossom.
Where masks flutter to the ground like flower petals, where the ash in the air isn't from forests burning but people burning, where everyone who wants the vaccine gets it but it isn't enough. Bill Gates says protecting copyrights is more important than human lives. Maybe that's why Melinda's divorcing him. Governor Brown will lift extreme risk restrictions in time for Mother's Day and says they won't come back. After the driest April, seeing how the winter bones of trees, the soil seemingly vacant of life, add so much color and volume so quickly gives me hope. Almost camouflaging the city's trash and homelessness, the high rents and grueling jobs, giving me this gorgeous now to strengthen me for what a dry late summer and unusually freezing winter might bring. I don't know if conditions will be right for me to flower fruit and make seeds for next year, let alone a city, state, or world. There will be surprises, not all of them bad, and the continuing gifts of resilience, compassion, and love, to quote Robin Wall Kimmerer, all flourishing is mutual. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 5th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Althea Billings. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Suzanne Potter, Nadia Romlagon, and Andrea Sears. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for COVID Noise Filter.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
So, welcome to COVID Noise Filter. My name is Dr. Mark Allen-Derry, and we are so happy to have guest co-hosting with us, Nurse Julia. Welcome to the show, Nurse Julia.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be coming on board with you guys.
Thank you so much. And now on to the show. Drug abuse and alcohol addiction. Now, the pandemic in many ways has exacerbated some pre-existing problems within the United States, and one of those issues is that of addiction. Today, we discuss two harsh developments, an increase in drug overdoses amongst Black Americans and a rise in alcoholic liver disease in young women. Now, the CDC reported that fatal drug overdoses have increased by 20% nationwide since the pandemic. This attributed to more than 83,000 deaths in 2020 alone. Though the CDC hasn't studied the racial breakdown among the deaths, a team of researchers at the University of Pennsylvania found that fatal drug overdoses surged by more than 50% amongst Black residents in Philadelphia. In comparison, the data on the fatal drug overdoses amongst white people remained rather flat, according to NPR, and even declined at certain periods. The racial disparities, which foster the disproportionate number of overdoses, stems from a history of war on drug policies and a lack of adequate access to treatment and rehabilitation programs, particularly amongst Black communities. In short, there is a massive lack of support measures in place to better curtail drug addiction and its negative impact on Black Americans. Now, in addition to the uptick in drug overdoses, there's been a recent increase in younger women in their 20s and 30s developing alcoholic liver diseases. The most common cause comes from increased in binge drinking. The University of Michigan reports that cases of alcoholic liver disease have increased by 30% in the past year. This is part of a trend which began over the last few years, in which more women, specifically younger women, are being diagnosed with alcoholic liver disease. NPR reports that there are several contributing pressures women face, even more so in the pandemic, that could contribute to the rise in binge drinking and liver disease. Similarly, a lack of adequate support early on leads to continued abuse and misuse of alcohol, thus leading to a dangerous and sometimes fatal disease of the liver.
Vaccine misinformation takes toll on Latinx communities. Vaccine data shows that Latinx people have been getting vaccinated at lower rates. Latinx represents 27% of the U.S. population, but only about 17% of those have been vaccinated. Part of the problem is the rapid spread of misinformation causing deeper mistrust by Latinx communities.
That's right. In fact, in response, Oscar Landano has used his community organization, We Count, to gain trust within immigrant communities in Homestead, Florida, largely populated by Latinx people. Landano notes that many Latinx individuals get their vaccine news through the grapevine of social media and word of mouth communication. And as we've covered before, social media can ignite the feuds of misinformation, especially when it comes to vaccines. With this population, there can be a language barrier, further limiting greater access to accurate, unbiased, and factual information.
Another facet of this mistrust in the vaccine comes from the historical mistrust by immigrant communities. Londano works with many undocumented immigrants who fear the vaccine could lead to getting deported. This is a community who has long been mistreated by leading powers and have a history of their privacy being invaded. In Florida, many vaccine sites require proof of residence, which has increased hesitancy from many of the Latinx population. However, Londano explains that this proof can be complicated for several members as the housing insecurity has impacted many Latinx.
Landano's goal is to increase their public health literacy by providing them greater access to accurate information. In his office, he has a computer lab in which members can come in and take advantage of internet resources. He hopes to increase the trust through shared knowledge of the facts and mitigate the harmful misinformation that spreads within the community. And let me just say on a final note here that COVID noise filter was invented particularly to help fight this misinformation. Remember, misinformation spreads by a factor of 6 times more than real information spread. So we're in it here with Mr. Oscar Landano. Again, another COVID noise filter hero, as far as yes. We are concerned. Kudos to you for your great work, sir.
A pattern begins to emerge in the symptoms of long-haul COVID sufferers. Some COVID-19 patients have had to suffer sometimes debilitating and everlasting effects long after contracting the virus. They are called long haulers, and there hasn't been much that doctors could do for them but try to treat their symptoms. But without a better understanding of what the virus is doing in the body, this can be challenging. Fortunately, that may be about to change as NBC News reports new research that suggests that long-term symptoms of COVID-19 may emerge in a distinct pattern over the course of weeks and months.
That's right. Natalie Lambert is an associate research professor at Indiana University School of Medicine. And Natalie surveyed over 5,000 long-haul COVID-19 patients. She found that specific symptoms tend to emerge at regular intervals, usually after about a week or 10 days. That results in what she calls waves of symptoms. More research is needed to confirm the results, but the early findings could give clinicians insights into treating long haulers more effectively and even preventing debilitating symptoms.
In the survey, Lambert asked patients what symptoms they had and how long after their illnesses they had begun. As she analyzed symptom onset, patterns begin to emerge. The first wave is flu-like symptoms such as fatigue, headache, fever, and chills. 5 days later, diarrhea, nausea, and vomiting appeared. 10 days into the illness, another wave of new symptoms happened, which are typically neurologic, including confusion, dizziness, and difficulty concentrating. There may also be joint pain and low back pain.
Some people reported pressure in the brain that is so intense that it feels like their heads might explode. 15 days into illness, another wave of new symptoms that includes high or low blood pressure, heart palpitation, and a tendency to faint. A week after that, which is about 21 days in, patients started experiencing issues like mouth sores, muscle twitching, eye infections, and a skin condition that has been referred to as COVID toes.
Currently, there's no way to tell if a person will become a long hauler. However, the news isn't all bleak, because anytime doctors can begin to predict the course of the disease, there's a greater ability to mitigate future problems.
That's right. This is a really interesting story. And one of the things that we are seeing is that people who have been vaccinated, these so-called long haulers or post-COVID syndrome, they're finding that the vaccines are actually helping to eliminate or ameliorate some of these symptoms. So another great reason to go get vaccinated.
Absolutely.
And then two, that's just such a great thing that we are seeing, that people are finding relief in the vaccine.
All right. Well, way to go, vaccine. That's awesome.
Americans are on the move. Now, the pandemic has initiated a whirlwind of changes within each of our lives, many of which will have lasting impacts for the future. One shift comes with the uptick in people, both individuals and groups of families, moving from one place to another just to live. Now, several Americans have taken the opportunity the pandemic has offered to move to someplace more preferable, as many jobs and educational programs have gone remote. Now, in the beginning of the pandemic, we did share a story with y'all about how many people living in crowded urban areas took the opportunity to move out of the big city to somewhere else, more affordable and spacious. With the flexibility remote and virtual systems offer, people felt that they had more of a stake in deciding where they wanted to live, especially considering how much time would likely be spent in their designated home. Now, it's fascinating to consider all the reasons people have had for moving in the last year. According to a Pew Research Center study, 33% of people who moved said it was due to financial reasons. Of the specified financial reasons, loss of a job appeared to be the main reason people changed their place of residence. Another interesting finding from the study was that the densely populated cities like New York, San Francisco, Chicago, and Los Angeles all saw dramatic moves out of the city. And across the country, data shows that temporary change of address request increased by 27% between February and July of 2020. Now, the producer of Noise Filter podcast is an example of this. He has lived in several different cities and even countries over the past year. After all, the independence which working remotely has provided. However, he says that he's ready to find the kind of belonging and stability which comes with having a long-term place to call home. This brings up the question whether or not the temporary address changes where people have decided to ride out the virus will be their forever homes, and whether we'll see a steady flow of people back to the cities. These are interesting questions, and I think only time will tell. New COVID-19 vaccine technologies. Now, one silver lining of the pandemic is that it sparked a creative fervor in new vaccine delivery technology. Could we soon have a COVID-19 without the use of a syringe? What? Let's see what this story is about. Nurse Julia?
I don't know. According to the Wall Street Journal, many companies are racing to find new alternatives to the typical shot-in-the-arm format. Some of these alternatives are a tube of sugar infused with the vaccine that is smaller than a grain of rice that is implanted under the skin.
Whoa.
Yeah. Dissolving implants, even freeze-dried vaccines made into lozenges that dissolve under the tongue, microneedle patches, electrical pulse systems, nasal sprays, and pills.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. In fact, speaking of pills, an experimental COVID-19 pill has shown positive preliminary results. The pill significantly reduced virus in subjects in mid-stage study after 5 days of treatment. Further study of the experimental antiviral is underway. If it proves capable of treating people with COVID-19 who show symptoms, the drug would bolster a limited arsenal of treatments and be the first oral antiviral against the disease. Infectious disease experts say that the experimental drug named molnupiravir could fill a key role by helping people who are sick at home, serving the same kind of role that's performed by Tamiflu for the flu.
All the new vaccine delivery alternatives are in the early to mid stages of development and clinical testing, which means it might be months or years before they are ready. However, if they are successful, these technologies could mean that booster vaccine doses might arrive in the mail one day. Vaccines can be kept on a shelf and administered even at home.
Wow, that's so cool. Now, vaccines could more easily be sent to the most remote or poor communities around the world without the necessity of complicated storage and trained medical staff. So we're definitely going to continue to watch that, but that's such a neat story. So
absolutely.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, these alternatives are next level, I'd say.
Yeah, they certainly are. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at Noise Filter on Instagram.